Well, good morning. I'm going to open an organizational meeting of the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. So in a moment, we will allow committee introductions, but we're trying to get a little bit of business out of the way first. So starting us off, I will entertain a motion to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules as presented.
Great. Representative Holvey moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion of the rules? Okay. Seeing none, is there any opposition? Okay. Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. Well, that was, is it always going to be this easy? Awesome. We're going to do a lot this session.
Always.
Great. So I will, we'll just start out to my left here with my good vice chair, and we'll just do, we have some time today, so a quick introduction of your district, whether, you know, how many terms you've served, and anything else you'd like all these fine folks to know about you. So go ahead.
So I'm Dan Rayfield, representing House District 16 with Corvallis, Philomath, Oregon State University, and I've been serving one day.
Hi. Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I'm late. I'm Mike Nierman. I'm from House District 23, so I'm a neighbor of Dan. His district
refuses to commute with me.
So I'm happy to be here on the Consumer Protection Committee. So.
Hi, everybody. Joe Gallegos, House District 30, which is New Hillsboro, North Plains, parts of Aloha, a couple of houses in Beaverton, and Helvetia, the farmland up in Helvetia, beautiful farmland. My district is the economic engine of the state, as you know, where all the tech industries are located. So very diverse community, and I'm looking forward to this committee.
Great.
Thank you.
And then we'll start to my right with our new committee administrator.
My name is Wendy Simons. I'll be the committee administrator for this committee this session.
And where are you from?
A lot of places, but I'm, in terms of legislatures, I worked at the Minnesota legislature for 5 years.
Paul Holvey, state representative from District 8, and lost count. I think I'm serving in my sixth session. I represent District 8 includes South Eugene, Fern Ridge area, Notai in the Lorain Valley down to Douglas County.
Sorry I'm late. My name is Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of Bend these days. My former life, I was an orthopedic surgeon. I designed medical products.
And Dwayne Stark, House District 4, which is Southern Oregon, the area between Grants Pass and Medford, and so a lot of rural area. It's, in my opinion, we had a debate about this yesterday, but the most beautiful part of the state. And so I'm eager to be up here where it never stops raining, and I bought a new rain jacket for the next 6 months.
Wonderful. And I'm Representative Shamia Fagan. I represent House District 51, which is outer southeast Portland, southwest Gresham, Boring, Damascus, Happy Valley, and unincorporated Clackamas County. And I come from the Columbia River Gorge, which is indisputably the most beautiful place in the state. But that's okay. We can go back and forth about that. I'll just never allow you an opportunity to speak during committee. Okay. Wonderful. So I'm going to close the organizational meeting. And now I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures. So what we're going to be doing now is introducing committee measures, which essentially means these measures will be filed as committee bills. Just a reminder that a vote to introduce the measure is not a vote on the endorsement of the content of the bill. However, if you would, you know, they have been posted on OLIS. If you haven't had an opportunity to look over them, upon a request, there's quite a few of them, so I won't necessarily have Wendy read a description of all of them, but if there's a particular bill that you would like a description of, please speak up and we'd be happy to have her introduce those. So I will entertain a motion to introduce committee measures.
And, Madam Chair, I would move to introduce the following legislative concepts as committee measures. LC 364, dated 6-6-2014. LC 927, dated 12-1-2014. LC-2739, dated 10-29-2014, LC-2743, dated 10-30-2014, LC-2744, dated 10-23-2014, LC-2745, dated 10-16-2014, LC-2910, dated 12-23-2014, LC-3095, dated 1-13-2015, and LC-3421, dated 1-20-2015.
Thank you. Are there any discussion of any of the measures in particular, or is there any measure that you would like Wendy to give a description of? No discussion? Okay, so seeing none, is there any opposition to introducing the entire list as committee measures? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes. So the following legislative concepts will be introduced as committee measures: LC-364, dated 6-6-14, LC-927, dated 12-1-14, LC-2739, dated 10-29-14, LC-2743, dated 10-30-14, LC-2744, dated 10-23-14, LC-2745, dated 10-16-14, LC-2910, dated 12-23-14, only two more. Hang in there. LC-3095, dated 1-13-15, and LC-3421, dated 1-20-15. So I'm going to close the work session. And now we get to the fun stuff. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2467, requested by Governor John A. Kitzhaber, M.D., for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So go ahead and come forward and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Vice Chair Buehler, Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Calley, and I am the Insurance Commissioner for the State of Oregon, and I'm here representing the Department of Consumer and Business Services to talk to you about House Bill 2467. So the bill would grant the Department of Consumer and Business Services the authority to regulate penalties, fees, and surcharges that insurers impose for early withdrawal for individual deferred annuities. And an individual deferred annuity is a contract that's typically used for retirement planning. And so what would happen is a consumer would purchase an annuity and over time make contributions to the annuity along the way. And then the insurance company who holds the annuity would agree to pay out payments in installments when the consumer actually chose to begin annuitizing. And there are incentives to keep consumers from withdrawing early. They're known as surrender charges or withdrawal charges. And there are two ways that insurance companies impose these charges. One is called the first in, first out method. The other is the last in, first out method. So what we're here to talk about in particular is concerns around the last in, first out method. So if you envision a situation where a consumer has purchased an annuity and they're getting ready to retire and they actually want to begin annuitizing, if they had made payments fairly recently, maybe within the last 3-5 years, under the last in, first out method, they'd actually be penalized and need to pay surrender charges because they had made payments relatively close to when they annuitize. And so what we'd propose to do is to adopt rules that would allow us to regulate method by which insurers apply these fees, and there are a number of different things that we may consider in making sure that they're appropriate and fair to the consumer. And in particular, we are interested in doing away with the last in, first out method to really focus on the date at which the consumer is first beginning to make these payments. And this approach would be consistent with the Interstate Insurance Compact that we belong to. So there's a compact of states that insurers can file their their annuities and other products with for review, and a large portion of annuities that are sold in Oregon are already approved through this compact. However, insurers have the choice. They can go to the compact or they can come to us. And the compact already enforces the first-in, first-out method. And what we would like to be able to do is, as a state, when we have insurers that come directly to us, that we be able to hold them to a similar standard. This, again, you know, grants fairly broad rulemaking authority with respect to these fees, but our intention is to stay fairly true to what the compact already provides for. And I will draw your attention to, there's a set of -1 amendments that I believe you have, very minor technical changes. It's just removing the word renewal. Typically in insurance you talk about renewing, but annuities don't renew like a typical insurance policy would. You know, once someone purchases the annuity, they continue paying that, and so it's just not applicable here. And I will stop there and see if you have any questions. Thank you.
So we have one other person to testify on this bill. So if you don't have questions, you may at the end. But are there any questions in particular for Laura? Yes.
I was curious. You had mentioned that there were some other things that you might be, you know, you had said the primary purpose is to kind of stop the last in, last out, but you kind of left it open that there might be some other things that you're considering. I was curious what those are.
Chair Fagan, Representative or Vice Chair Rayfield. So the way the bill is structured, it actually allows us the ability to look at the size of the fees, not just when they're charged, but actually to look at the reasonableness of the fees. And so I would think that that would be something we would look at as well, just to make sure that they're, you know, really appropriate to cover any costs and to cover the risk that an insurer might bear if someone were to withdraw earlier. And so we just think that it's an important consumer protection for us to have the ability to just look more closely and scrutinize whether those fees are reasonable. So I think that that's another piece, not just the methodology, but the magnitude of the fees themselves.
I just had one follow-up. So this is obviously a broad rulemaking capability, but if the main purpose is just to do the last in, last out, or just look at the size of that, why not narrowly tailor the legislation just to do those things?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, I do think with, you know, when we look at annuities, this is an area where we haven't had a lot of new law in the last several years. And so one of the reasons that we're here before you is because the things that are evolving in terms of these products have really outpaced some discussion kind of in terms of how we should be regulating them and what consumer protections are necessary. I think that what's important here is that this gives us the flexibility to continue to scrutinize and look at what's in the best interest of the consumer. And, you know, we would certainly be happy to continue to come back and work with this committee to, you know, talk a little bit more about what kind of the policy issues are that we're seeing with annuities. But I think it's important here that we not just talk about the methodology, but that we have the ability to more really have the scrutiny to be able to protect consumers in these contracts. They're rather complex, and I think it's something that we can do to help people when they're planning for long-term retirement.
Representative Buehler.
Laura, how do you determine reasonable, or how do you define it?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Buehler. So in this case, we would understand what is the surrender charge in this example meant to cover. And so often what's happening is that an insurer is investing funds that that a consumer is paying to purchase and then pay for the annuity. And so there is a need to guarantee or be able to cover a certain return in order to make payments at the agreed upon interest rates. And so one of the things we would look at is whether or not the surrender charges accurately reflect the risk that the insurer may not be able to pay the agreed upon interest rate. So we look at the dynamics of the contract and understand what returns the insurer expects to be able to make, and then what risk factors might come into play that might either cause that return to be higher or lower. And that might be one way we would look at whether the surrender charge is reasonable.
What about their administrative costs? Would that be
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Bueller, yes, that would be considered as well. So if there were, you know, because of an early withdrawal, if suddenly they had to do more administrative work, and that would figure in and be part of the justification, that would be something we consider as well.
So is that process outlined in administrative rules, or how is it done, or is it just left open?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Bueller, I believe, and I will confirm, I don't believe that it's in rule at all at this point. I think this is not addressed, and that's why we're here before this committee asking to provide more authority for us to lay that out. And I think that's one of the things that we can accomplish in rulemaking is setting clear expectations for what we would consider in determining the reasonableness of these charges. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Kelly, so is it just surrender charges? Does this bill just have to do with surrender charges, or are there other consumer protection issues that this bill is addressing?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, currently it's really focused on the charges that are imposed, and I'm just going to read here from the bill, for withdrawal before maturity or after the owner or annuitant dies. So these are, you know, surrender charges. There are a couple of different instances where we're planning to deal with this. But, you know, that's really the focus here. But if there are other issues that, you know, the committee would like us to take a look at, you know, we're happy to come back and provide information as well.
Thank you.
Any other? Yes, Representative Bueller.
Laura, tell me how other states deal with this issue. Do you have a sense of policy procedure?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Bueller. So I mentioned the compact, first of all, which is where the majority of these contracts are being filed. And so currently they do not allow the last in, first out method. And I will need to get back to you in terms of the specific laws that the other states have passed with respect to the last in, first out. But I'm happy to follow up with you.
And how many states are involved in this interstate compact?
You know, I think I may have that here. Let me just double check. So Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Bueller, 44 states are members of the compact, and that represents about 70% of the premium volume countrywide for life and annuities.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now we will hear from John Mangan.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm the Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers. We're a national trade association of 288 life insurers that write 90% of the annuities in the United States and in Oregon. We work closely, obviously, with our regulator, Commissioner Kelly. And I'm here today because we support the concept of the Interstate Compact in the 44 states it's adopted. It's designed to help get us a level playing field and sure and clear guidelines for products so we can get them approved in nationwide in a streamlined fashion. And we're grateful to the state of Oregon for putting the compact in place. It's increased the efficiency of filings in Oregon. A filing is when we send the annuity contract to the division, they have to approve it for use and sale in the state. So they screen all the provisions. The compact helps streamline that. So to the extent that this bill adopts the interstate compact standard for the first-in, first-out protocol, we support that. That's a compact standard, and that will align Oregon with the rest of the country. And I mentioned that to staff, that we support that concept. I was not aware that there may be in the rulemaking some other activity that could take place in terms of the reasonableness of fees or other things. We may wish to discuss those issues with the staff because we're not sure exactly where they might be going with that. But again, our support is for the Interstate Compact rule that's outlined as the intent of the bill. And beyond that, the commissioner obviously has a lot of authority to review new filings, and we're not aware of any issues with unreasonable fees or other issues. So with that proviso, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Mangan? You going to let him off easy? Okay, very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
And those are the only two on my list. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2467? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 20 or should I Is there anyone, does anyone just want to make a general comment for the record before I close the hearing, actually, I should ask? Okay, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2467 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2470, requested by Governor John A. Kitzhaber, MD, for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And go ahead, Mr. Patrick Allen, Director of DCBS.
Thanks, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The department is the state's largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. And since I suspect you'll see a number of bills this session that either are from us or deal with us, I thought I might take just a quick moment to give you a little bit of an overview of what we do and how we do it and some of our approach to regulation. You heard earlier from Commissioner Calley, the insurance division is a part of what we do. We regulate largely the financial services industry in the state. We do it through a division of finance and corporate securities that focuses on depository institutions and lending institutions primarily, as well as securities law. The insurance division regulates all insurance in the state. Unlike things like banks and credit unions, states are supreme in the regulation of insurance. There's not federal regulation in that area. We also regulate the worker safety and compensation system in the state, so Oregon OSHA, focused on preventing workplace injuries and illness, as well as the workers' compensation division that administers the system of workers' compensation insurance through companies you've heard of like SAFE, as well as a variety of other private companies. We also regulate construction standards in the state through the Building Codes Division, which sets the standards that buildings are built to for things like electrical and plumbing and structural, as well as earthquake standards, energy efficiency, those kinds of things, and also licenses professionals in skilled construction trades like plumbers and electricians. They also, through a grant of authority to about 135 cities and counties around the state, administer the local system of plan review and inspection. So when you think of going to get a building permit and having a building work inspected, in most parts of the state, that's a city or a county who's been granted authority by the department to do that work. When we think about our regulatory mission, our mission is to serve and protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. And we really look at that as sort of two co-equal halves to our mission, focused on consumers and workers, but also that positive business climate element. There's an important consumer protection element or reason for that. That's not just sort of a way of saying we're going to regulate people to protect consumers and make sure we don't hurt the economy while we do it. We really want to regulate industries in a way that makes them attractive for multiple entrants into those industries, because we believe competition from providers is one of the most powerful consumer protection tools available. So, for example, in the area of health insurance, we have, according to the American Medical Association, about 2 years ago, the most competitive private health insurance market in the country. And we think that's a good thing for consumers, mm-hmm. because the ability to take your business from one provider to another is itself a valuable consumer protection tool. House Bill 2470 is what I would like to think of as a simple bill that proves there are no simple bills. And it's basically this. The agency exists as a merger in the 90s of a number of independent agencies that each had their own regulatory statutes and authorities and exemptions and all sorts of things. The basic issue is we came across a circumstance where we found that in some parts of the regulatory statutes we administer, it was possible while we were investigating somebody for potential violation of consumer protection law for that party to do a public records request and get our investigatory file while the investigation is going on. And that's sort of at the level of just common sense seems a little strange and awkward. And we did some digging and found that there are places in securities law potentially, as well as some other consumer protection areas where, in fact, it was not clear that we could assert some of the other kinds of exemptions from public records requests that we had available to us in law to be able to protect those records while we're investigating someone. So, if you will, someone we suspect of defrauding consumers, for example, would be able to file a public records request and figure out where are we and what do we know and what have we gotten so far, and that can have a chilling effect on the ability to effectively investigate a case. So the intent of House Bill 2470 is to simply clearly department-wide give us an exemption from public records disclosure while we're investigating a case. The intent is that once that investigation is concluded and we either either find that there was no violation or we move to an actual enforcement case, then those records are available, as is the case generally today when someone is accused of a violation and goes through a contested case process or whatever. Bill didn't come out quite that way. You've got, a letter from the Bar Association, which I think I largely agree with in terms of their observations about the bill as originally drafted. I believe you also have a dash one amendment on OLIS that's our at least first attempt at trying to address some of those concerns and narrow the scope of the bill. Today, what I would suggest is that we're prepared to sit down with them and other stakeholders who've got concerns that I think are quite reasonable about the way the bill was initially drafted to get us back to that original concept of not having to release investigatory records during an investigation. And once the investigation is done, have those become generally the kinds of public records that they are. There are some parts of our statute, for instance, that protect consumer confidentiality or confidentiality of personal financial information or those kinds of things that would remain. But in general, the idea is once the investigation is done, the records would become public. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Allen?
Yeah, I just had a... Oh, sorry. When I was looking at the dash one amendment on the subsection four of the new edition, it basically says that after the investigation is concluded, any documents that were subject to subsection one are subject to disclosure after the ongoing investigation is concluded. I guess the one issue that I had, and I just want clarification, in the actual bill, it talks about admissibility in civil trial, and the dash one amendment doesn't discuss admissibility in trial. And so is it your intent that while these, with the dash one amendment, that the information would be discoverable but still under the entire bill would not be admissible at trial?
Yeah, Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, two things about that. I think that's part of what we believe we need to sit down with trial lawyers and others and work through. The only other thing I would suggest is that, back to the point about things like sensitive financial records, I think there will be the interplay of two different sets of public records disclosure standards that will exist when we're done. May or may not touch on admissibility, but there will be things that would remain that would continue not to be disclosable, like Social Security numbers as an example, or those kinds of things. And so that may touch on that topic as well. But largely, this is something we want to work through with stakeholders.
Okay. So you're not stuck on the admissibility issue? Okay.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair. So the idea of discovery is kind of and I don't mean to make a legal argument. My neighbor Dan will laugh at me if I do. But the principle of discovery is that you get to know what the other party has on you, and that doesn't. What I'm trying to not do is to like hold you to a legal standard, but kind of more of a standard and principle of isn't that a good thing for if I'm under investigation by DCB? Yes, shouldn't I have a right, morally kind of in principle, to know what you guys are investigating me for? I mean, with outside of things like, for instance, you mentioned Social Security numbers, and there's other things that fall under other protections, all that. But shouldn't I have a right to know that?
Sure, Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman. Yes, the question is when. And what I would distinguish between is the period of time that we're investigating a case and the point that we determine that we think something has gone wrong and we actually say, Representative Nierman, we think you violated ORS whatever. At that point, I think we're on the same page that when we move from investigation to an enforcement action, then discovery should absolutely be on the table, and that's where everyone shows their cards and we proceed to whatever the prescribed contested case process is. But while we're in the midst of doing that investigation, we think the ability to for you to get ahead of us, find out what's going on in the investigation, anticipate arguments, those kinds of things, it actually can damage the investigation at that earlier stage, and that's what we're trying to protect.
And I kind of get that. So does the statute do that, or does the bill do that? Does it draw that line that say while you're investigating, I can't do a public records request, but as soon as you start litigating, then I can?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, I think that's one of the key things that the initial draft of the bill does not do well is draw that distinction.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
And so it's your intent essentially to have this bill create a situation that's very similar to, say, the criminal world, where during the police investigation, all the information remains confidential. The public information request, you're not going to get a copy of the police report until the investigation is concluded. However, once the criminal proceedings start at that point, then there is discovery to the litigants in that case, or the criminal defendant, so that way they're able to defend themselves. However, even in that stage, when things are not concluded in a criminal sense, a private party still wouldn't be able to get access to, say, the police report.
Yeah, Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, I need to be a little careful because there's sort of a distinction, I believe, between the lay understanding of the answer to the question you just asked and a legal understanding of the question that you just asked. From a legal standpoint, criminal and civil matters are quite different, and so it would really be inaccurate to say it would be like a criminal case. But what you just outlined from a lay standpoint of the notion of getting to the place where we've you know, demarked between investigation and enforcement, and we then change to a different world where people are entitled to see what's the case against them and answer that case is very much what we're shooting for.
Representative Stark.
Thank you. What is the average timeline for an investigation, and how is it marked no longer active and therefore moves on to yes, this can be disclosed?
Sure. Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, the range within the agency can be vast. Let me give you a sense of kind of the sorts of things we're talking about when we talk about investigations. They can range from very straightforward cases, almost resolved on site, where we're trying to figure out is someone doing plumbing work with or without a plumber's license, to investigations of a work site where an injury has occurred. Those kinds of cases are subject to federal time limits, but it can go on for a handful of months, to extensive fraud and securities investigations that often involve partnering with federal agencies and in some cases can actually go on for a number of years, driven largely by that interplay. Those cases certainly at the very long-term end of the spectrum are very much the exception, but they also are the ones that generate voluminous records and that get into some of the issues of are those investigations disturbed by early release of those records.
So, can I follow? So, is there the possibility of abusing this in the sense of we don't want this ever disclosed, and therefore we don't formally conclude an investigation?
Certainly. Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, I think the important thing to remember is Oregon's public records law is a public records law, and it starts with the premise that all records are public. And what it provides me is, if I have an exemption in the law, it provides me the opportunity to assert that a record is not public, but it doesn't give me any kind of a right to stand on that. First of all, I always have the discretion to release a record even if it's subject to an exemption, assuming it's not something that we talked about earlier on social security numbers or something like that. Gives me the discretion always to release a public record, and in fact says that what I'm supposed to do is look and see if it's in the public interest to release that record. If at the end of the day someone believes that I've made the wrong call with that discretion, then there's an appeal process through the Attorney General that allows someone to go get that call reviewed by an independent body to see if I have released records in the public interest. And so, I mean, yeah, technically, in theory, there's the ability to abuse that. But I think in Oregon, it's quite limited due to the structure and nature of the law.
Any other questions? Just one question that I had, which I'm assuming is something that you and Mr. Towers will work out for the trial lawyers, is, and it's very germane to Mr. or Representative Stark's question, which is that if a civil litigant is facing maybe a statute of limitations issue or some other kind of other than, some other opposed deadline, a court deadline, a discovery deadline, some other kind of, trials coming up, and your investigation is not concluded, and yet they need, as part of their evidence against, for example, a bank or some other, entity that you may be investigating, considering if there's some exemption to this law that says if there's a circumstance that basically them not getting those documents via public record request because your investigation is not concluded will preclude them from actually obtaining all the evidence they would need via subpoena or otherwise to actually, litigate their case. So that's just a concern that I see for maybe some of these investigations that go on for years. Mm-hmm. If there's a, you know, if there's a filed case or a litigant considering filing a case and they're facing deadlines and yet your investigation is ongoing and those documents are still exempt, I just see a little bit of a concern there.
And this probably gets out of my depth of familiarity with the ins and outs of these cases, but I'm trying to imagine a case where a litigant, where we have a record that we would not release to a litigant, that the litigant, because we would have gotten it from someone, right?
Okay.
And that the litigant wouldn't have had the ability to discover the same document from the same entity that we got it from. So we're kind of layering hypotheticals in here a little bit. I think I follow your question, and it would be best if what I try to do is come back and answer it more fully in the future.
Right, because there are certainly situations in litigation where you suspect or know that a certain document exists, you're asking for it from the other party, and the other party's saying, we don't have it, we can't find it. So
right.
Then you just go subpoena a third party that you know would otherwise have it. So that's
right.
Kind of a situation where I could imagine,
yeah.
Which, you know, happens not infrequently in litigation, where you know a certain document exists, they don't have it, they can't find it, etc. And so you're trying to go get it via subpoena. So I see that being just a potential issue for you to work out.
Sure.
Do you have a comment as well?
I was just going to follow up on what Chair Fagan said. Sometimes it's also helpful to see the handwritten notes of the individual doing the investigation,
mm-hmm.
Or looking at, you know, the audio tapes and, you know, various things like that that may not have been captured in other different types of scenarios. So those can be very valuable. I mean, you could even put in something, you know, and I'll leave you guys to the solutions where, you know, upon a judge's order with a protective order, something along those lines to kind of protect your interests as well. I'm sure there's a lot of different solutions.
Okay. Thank you.
And Representative Nierman, any other comments? Okay. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So do you have any, I'm curious as to where this legislation comes from. Do you have any examples of when you did have somebody try to uncover the goods on themselves?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, we had a case in 2013 where ultimately some late-breaking federal intervention kept us from having to to disclose documents, but it was in a securities fraud case. I believe it was a fraud case where we had that kind of a circumstance where the assertion was made and was proving difficult to defend that we needed to make those records available. Yeah, that was a case where we had a partnership investigation going on, and so the federal role was able to help resolve that. But that was the proximate case that got us looking at this carefully.
And so you didn't end up disclosing the documents?
In that particular case, that's right. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you very much.
And I don't have anyone else signed up, but is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2470? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2470. And that is all that's on our agenda today. Look at that. Paul didn't think I could do it.
Paul's not happy.
Cool. Well, is there anything else for the good of the order? Very nice. Well, I will close the meeting of the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.
Madam Chair, I do want to say
effectiveness.
Madam Chair, I do want to say
action in government.